Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this, Tuesday, the 24th of January. We talk about dogs this hour of the program. I must tell you that today is Chrissy's last day, in case you didn't know that. She's going to Minnesota Public Radio, and I'll miss her very much. She's done a great job. Say goodbye to her. Wish her well as you call in today. But Chrissy and I share an extraordinarily deep love of dogs, and we have spent, I mean, we do our jobs, but we've spent hours on the internet going to fix our dog fix by looking at, you know, the dogs that are available at the Humane Society, by looking at breeds we would like to have, by filling our houses with way, way, way too many dogs. We don't go ahead and do it, but you know, we fantasize about it. So we've done some programs on dogs. I am criticized. You know, my husband says, give her a guest who knows Abraham Lincoln or dogs, and that's it. And there is some truth in that, I must confess. But this is a really interesting article. It's on the cover of National Geographic this month, and it's What Dogs Tell Us, the ABCs of DNA. Adam Boyko is assistant professor of biomedical science at Cornell University and is going to be with us this hour. He and family members have conducted really extensive surveys of animals, dogs in Africa, and also searching for South American dogs that disappeared from the South American continent at some point to find out why they disappeared. He is assistant professor in biomedical sciences at the Cornell University College of Veterinary Medicine, and his research focuses on the genome investigation of dogs as a model of genetic disease and evolutionary genetics. One aspect of this work is understanding the evolution and genetics of village dogs, and there are some pictures in National Geographic of these dogs that have a DNA that's very close to the wolf, although they don't look a whole lot like wolves. Dr. Boyko is a graduate of the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and also went to Purdue University. He's with us this hour as we talk about what dogs tell us, and we'll be welcoming phone calls for him as well. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you'd like to send an email, you can do that as well. It's talk@wpr.org. He joins us from the studios at Cornell University, and thank you so much, Adam, for being with us.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. So tell me, what piqued your curiosity in these village dogs in Africa? What did you think we might be able to learn from them?
Well, I'd been working as a postdoc in Carlos Bustamante's lab on this project looking at purebred dog DNA, which is, you know, of course, a really interesting system for finding all sorts of genes that control all sorts of traits, as the National Geographic article so nicely showed. And I always had the nagging question in the back of my mind of, well, most of the dogs in the world aren't actually these purebred dogs that we sort of see at dog shows and are a lot of the pets that we see in the United States. But in fact, when you travel the world, you're typically greeted by, you know, street dogs. And when you go out to remote villages, you're greeted by these village dogs. And I really had no idea what these dogs were. And I looked in the literature and nobody else seemed to know. Some people just sort of assumed that they were, you know, just sort of mutts that had gotten free and interbred, and so they're just basically complex mixes of breed dogs. But I wondered, well, they're sort of living a life like dogs probably first lived when they evolved from wolves. And so maybe they've just been around all the time. And maybe it's just in the past few hundred years that we have these modern breeds that we start to export to all the continents. But in fact, those populations of dogs that we see in the streets and villages aren't really mixtures of those dogs, but they're the dogs that have been there all along. And so I got a grant from Cornell University to sort of do some pilot work. And fortuitously, my brother and sister-in-law were starting grad school and going on a honeymoon to Africa.
That's great. And I love this story.
Right. And yeah, it was fantastic. I had the meeting with my advisor, Carlos, and sort of proposed the project sort of on a whim. And we got funding and we did it.
So your brother and sister-in-law got DNA samples from hundreds of dogs, huh?
Yeah. So their honeymoon, they collected over 300 blood samples from three different countries in Africa. They actually visited about a dozen different countries. And so over the years, we've actually used them in other locations. And then most recently, they and I went down to Peru, and we sort of traveled around Peru for part of this National Geographic-funded expedition to see what's happened to Native American dogs and are there any of them left.
When you looked at the blood of these dogs in Africa, you found that most of the village dogs were as closely related to wolves as they were to fully domesticated dogs, more closely related to wolves?
Yeah, so it depends how you look at it. So they're definitely dogs. You know, they're not wolves. So if you look genetically and you were to cluster them, you would cluster them together with other dogs. But what happens is when you have a breed of dogs, they go through this intense bottleneck, and that what geneticists would call genetic drift happens extremely rapidly. And so you change the frequencies of the genes that are in these breeds, and so they genetically look very, very different from what their ancestors looked like. And of course, some of that translates into the phenotype too. So, you know, of course, we have long, curly furred, you know, purebred dogs, and you don't typically see that in the village dogs. Whereas with the village dogs, they haven't really gone through big bottlenecks. So there's a very large population size of village dogs. And so there just hasn't been much chance for drift to change the gene frequencies at all in these village
dogs. Oh, that's interesting.
So they genetically resemble the ancestral sort of original domestic dog much more closely. And so they make an ideal population then for looking at changes that happened in the beginning with dogs. Mm-hmm. To sort of form dogs, whereas these purebred dogs make an excellent system for looking at the genes that are underlying all these traits that have been intensely selectively bred into and out of the various breeds.
Mm-hmm. What did you find? There was a general kind of temperament among these village dogs. Were they friendly? Were they helpful?
Yeah, I think in Africa, almost without exception, the dogs were extremely friendly and easygoing. Puerto Rico, it was the same way. I mean, it was easier to draw blood from most of these dogs than it was from my pet dog at home.
Really?
But in some other countries, dogs could behave more aggressively, and I think that had some sort of function of just, you know, what their social environment was and how people and the dogs typically interacted. We didn't take scientific measurements of aggression levels, so we don't really have a nice controlled study to say that. But you know, just my sense is overall they're very well-mannered dogs.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned Puerto Rico. What were you doing in Puerto Rico?
Well, that was the pilot project to make sure we could actually, you know, coax dogs and draw blood from them and
right.
Get DNA out of it. You know, I'm more of a computer scientist geneticist type. It had been a few years since I had done field work, so it was a very fun project.
And the genomes, tell me about this in more detail, reflected a state of early domestication before artificial selection and inbreeding, directed, of course, by human beings, had taken over. So we're seeing sort of a natural selection. How does that manifest itself?
Well, one way that it manifests itself is you don't see quite the same extremes of phenotypic variation in the village dogs that you see in purebred dogs. So purebred dogs are notable. They've got the largest variation in body size of any land mammal. So you've got teacup chihuahuas that are probably 4 or 5 pounds. And then you've got, you know, giant mastiffs that are over 200 pounds. So you've got this 50-fold variation in body size, which is extremely large for a mammal. And in the village dogs, we weighed every single village dog, which is not an easy task. So we took a goat sling and a spring scale, and we hoisted all the dogs up to figure out how much they weighed. And we could look at what the variation was within populations, and then whether or not dogs in different countries weighed different amounts. And then because we did a genetic analysis, we could see if it was the same genes that were controlling body size in the same way in the village dogs as the purebred dogs. And what we see is that the genes themselves, of course, are the same, which you would expect. I mean, these are, you know, the same species of animal. But the way that the genetic diversity is structured is very different. And so in purebred dogs, what we see is the size variation is is underlied by just a few genes of major effect.
Mm-hmm.
So if I flip the switch on two or three genes, I've, you know, changed a miniature poodle into a giant poodle, like body size wise.
Uh-huh.
Whereas with the village dogs, it's a much more subtle pattern, and the genes that are making the differences, you know, let's say between the smallest populations of village dogs that we found, which were in the highlands of Papua New Guinea. That's many, many, many genes. We can't even identify all of them, but most of them have much smaller effects, and that makes them different from the big dogs that we see in the mountains of Lebanon.
What would have happened if you had taken one of those village dogs home?
I don't know. I definitely wanted to and was tempted to. I don't know exactly what the rules are. I'm talking to some of the veterinarians here to see how long the quarantine would be, and it probably depends on which country. But, you know, some of the dogs are living such a great life. I would feel bad about taking them out of that environment. They're sort of in their element. You know, certainly other dogs, particularly in urban areas, look like they're having a much tougher time.
Yeah. So why are these dogs having a great life? What's their life?
They're lounging on the side of the road. They're helping herd the animals. You know, there's no fences or collars, so they get to play together and run around whenever they want to. You know, it's a dog's life for some of them.
Aww. And what did you learn, if anything, about where dogs first appeared as a result of this work?
Well, we're learning that the situation is pretty complicated. Right now, what the geneticists are saying is that dogs originated in East Asia. And that's based on analysis of just one part of the DNA, which the mitochondrial DNA. So it's only inherited through the mother. And, you know, that's based on a whole lot of samples. But we think looking at a whole lot of village dogs could actually improve that story significantly, and looking at the whole genome of the dog versus just one genetic marker. So that's a project that's ongoing right now. We've done a lot of the genetic analysis. I don't think I'm quite ready to say that we have a definitive answer to that yet, but I feel like we're getting, you know, much closer.
Mm. How much closer? When are you going to know? Soon?
Yeah. I think geneticists are going to find out within the next year or two and have a pretty good study. Certainly the archaeologists have a say too. I mean, there's all sorts of interesting archaeological finds that keep coming up. You know, particularly things that look like dogs that are older than what the geneticists are saying how old dogs were. So there's a lot to work out. I'm not going to say it's going to be completely worked out within a year or two, but I think that from the genetics angle, there'll be some further studies certainly in that time frame.
Now, you've also, I don't know if this is related in some way, and if so, please tell me, or if it's an entirely separate study, but I know that you conducted research, I believe, last summer, looking at the disappearance of native dogs in South America, which is pretty extraordinary. I didn't know that they pretty much completely disappeared and were replaced with dogs with European heritage. Are you studying a similar thing here, or are we on a different topic? But if so, I'm interested in what happened to all those dogs.
No, I think it's very similar. I mean, we know that the Native Americans brought dogs with them, and we know this from burials and genetic analysis of the dogs in those burials. So we know what some of the genetic signatures are we should be looking for. And yet when we go out, say, to Puerto Rico or to Mexico, and we sample dogs that we find in animal shelters there, they look European. Mm-hmm. And so we thought that, well, maybe we need to get a little further away from these urban centers. Maybe if we get out into the country enough, we're going to be able to find dogs that don't show an appreciable amount of European ancestry, but instead look like their ancestors were the dogs that the Native Americans had. And so we applied to get funding from National Geographic, and they graciously gave us money. And so we're looking at a few different populations that we think might harbor these ancestral variants. And one particularly exciting country to us was Peru. So we thought it would be good to be on the western side of the continent. And Peru has a lot of geographic diversity as well. And they have some very interesting ancient dog remains as well, and Peruvian hairless dogs. So we sampled pretty extensively in that country and are getting ready to start that genetic analysis. So that project is still a bit in its infancy right now.
Mm-hmm. So you don't really have any ideas of why those dogs disappeared?
Well, I mean, we certainly have some ideas. It's true that there are reports in the 1800s when, you know, the Native Americans were being, you know, moved onto reservations, that the dogs were slaughtered behind. Hmm. But even earlier than that, in trade, it seemed as though the Native Americans would often trade for European dogs. But whether this was true continent-wide, I find that kind of hard to believe. And so so I think in some pockets we'll probably see some dogs that have at least some of their genome coming from these Native American dogs. And as a geneticist, that would be extremely exciting, because then that means we have this lineage of dogs that was separated from all the rest of the dogs for over 10,000 years.
Ooh.
And so that's a lot of time for evolution to take place. And so one of the things, for instance, in Peru that would be interesting to see, if we can find these ancient Native American dogs, we can ask questions about what are they adapted to high altitude genetically?
Mm.
I mean, we
mm.
know human populations get adapted to high altitude after that many generations. So we would expect dogs maybe are too, and we could learn new things about those traits.
Oh, that's interesting. And did you see any similarities at all, or is it a completely different animal, the native dogs in South America and the native dogs in Africa?
Oh, there's definitely similarities. Genetically, I'm sure they're extremely, extremely different. If I had to guess, I haven't done all the math yet, but the South American dogs looked a little bit smaller, a little bit more chihuahua-like. You know, the African dogs had more of a Basenji kind of gestalt, but if you just showed me a whole bunch of Polaroids, I'm not sure that I would be able to categorize them with, you know, more than 80% accuracy.
Mm-hmm. And how did we get to a point, Adam, where, and there are pictures of both in the Always Gorgeous National Geographic, when we had these village dogs, and then all of a sudden we have, you know, we've got boxers, we've got Bichons, we've got Doberman Pinschers, we've got, you know, you name it, Tibetan Mastiffs. We've got all these great varieties of dogs. At what point did that happen in human history, and how did that happen that we started getting the breeds that we're familiar with now?
Well, I think it was happening for thousands of years. There had been some lineages where you've got populations that were intensely managed by people. They were being bred to do specific things. And so there were Mastiff-like warrior dogs a few thousand years ago. And, you know, there were Saluki-like dogs in Egypt that perhaps were the forerunners of modern-day Salukis and Afghan hounds and other sorts of caravan hounds a few thousand years ago. I mean, we know all of this from archaeological evidence, and certainly in Asia there were some ancient Asian breeds as well. But I think back then the vast majority of dogs just sort of were living their day-to-day existence without much interference with humans in matters involving reproduction. And so to me, that makes them village dogs. And it wasn't until the Victorian era, I think, that this idea of selective breeding within closed populations where you've defined what constitutes a breed. So you sort of have this founder population, and then all the matings are arranged between individuals within this founder population, and that's propagated forward. You know, that really took off then. And so the origin for perhaps most of the breeds that we see today is only about 100 generations ago. And yet in that time, we've vastly changed the phenotypes. So there was a lot of phenotypic diversity to begin with. Some of that was directed by humans. But it, you know, just this explosion, I think, is mainly over the last 200 or 300 years.
Oh, that's not very long, is it?
No. I mean, certainly in evolutionary timescales, it's just a blink of an eye, which
right.
makes it a really fascinating system. I wouldn't be surprised if dogs were the youngest species of mammal on the planet. You know, they've only been around perhaps for 15, 20,000 years.
Hmm. Well, we're going to welcome phone calls for our guest. Adam Boyko is our guest this hour. We're, in case you get National Geographic, look at the February issue. The cover story is What Dogs Tell Us, the ABCs of DNA. It goes on the first page to say scientists have found the secret recipe behind the spectacular variety of dog shapes and sizes, and it could help unravel the complexity of human genetic disease. We have yet to get to that part of the conversation, which we will in just a moment. Adam is assistant professor in biomedical sciences at the Cornell University College of Veterinary Medicine, and his research is focusing on the genomic investigation of dogs as a model of genetic disease and evolutionary genetics. And he's done some fascinating studies of the DNA of village dogs in Africa and also looked at the disappearance of village dogs in South America. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. A few announcements. One is the State of the Union address will be tonight at 8 o'clock. You can hear it here on the Ideas Network. Number two is, this is Chrissy's last day. Please wish her well. I'll miss her so much. You know, it also means there's a job opening here, too. I don't see why I can't say that. It's in Milwaukee. It's a Milwaukee-based job. You have to be, you know, creative and love what we do. So if you want more information, dash me an email and I'll let you know. I think it's going to be posted soon. Okay, and what else do I want to say? Oh, I want to say, well, I'll hold what I was going to say for a moment. I'll say it after we pause. It's about tomorrow's show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this hour, we love doing presidential books. I think we did Ulysses S. Grant just last week, didn't we? Great show. Great guest. Tomorrow it's James Madison, our fourth president. And Richard Brookhiser will be our guest. He's the author of the book James Madison. He's a senior editor of National Review and the author of a number of other books, including George Washington on Leadership and What Would the Founders Do? He has hosted the PBS documentaries Rediscovering George Washington and Rediscovering Alexander Hamilton. So it should be a great show tomorrow at 10. All right, let's go to phone calls. Here's the number, 800-486-8655. Mark in Milwaukee is our first caller for you. Adam, hi, Mark.
Hi, I have a question. If the modern dog species is a pretty recent development of diversification, what's the common ancestor for all dog species, which is the wolf? When did it diverge from another common species? One went one way and one went the other.
All right. So it would be millions of years ago. I can't give you an exact number. I just don't have it off my head. But wolves and coyotes, I think, are about 3 million years diverged. And then since that time is when you've got the diversification of gray wolves throughout Eurasia and North America. I think the North American versus Eurasian gray wolf split about a million or so years ago. So they're pretty distinct. But they, you know, they can freely hybridize. They all have the same number of chromosomes.
Right.
In fact, all the way back out to the golden jackal, you can still get hybridizations. It's all the same genus, Canis. You have some things that are called wolves, like maned wolves or Ethiopian wolves, that are actually different species entirely and not as closely related at all. But yeah, it's a very interesting system because there's been, you know, hybridization going on in modern times. There's been integration. So we see a lot of black coloration in wolves in North America now, and we can tell that that actually came from the dogs.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but what I really meant was that coyotes and wolves diverged from a common ancestor. So what was the common? I mean, there would have to be another from Canis, you
right.
know, is coyotes and so forth. But there, what was the common ancestor in which the other in the group diverged from, and what would be there?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think you'd have to get at that with archaeology. I honestly don't know if the common ancestor was more wolf-like or more coyote-like. You would expect it would be similar to one or the other, or some sort of amalgam of both. And I honestly don't know the answer.
But wolves, coyotes came from an ancestor that was one thing in the past. And what would that? And what animal diverged from that? One went canis. What? The other one went what? Feline. You see what I'm saying?
Well, that would be even further back to get to feline. Now you're talking about tens of millions of years. Yeah, so the ancestor way back then probably hasn't stayed the same for the last 20 million years. So we don't have a modern example of what that was. So we have to infer what it is, you know, based on paleontology and whatnot.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Mark, for your call. All right, let's now get to the part of this that has human implications. your studies, this article says, could help unravel the complexity of human genetic disease. How so?
Well, one thing, obviously, geneticists are really, really interested in human disease and figuring out what variation in the human genome is responsible for different traits in humans, especially disease traits. And human genetics is very complicated. We're a pretty diverse species. Different populations of people are all pretty similar genetically, and they share a whole bunch of variation with each other. And so it becomes hard to try to figure out variants that underlie what we call complex traits, which are things that are under the influence of a whole lot of genes. And so one example is in body size. So if you want to figure out which genes are responsible for variation in human height, you have to look at thousands and thousands of people across hundreds of thousands of markers before you can start to get significant statistical associations between certain markers and the trait of interest, which is human height for this. And in fact, it took geneticists 100,000 people in their study, genotyped at hundreds of thousands of markers before they could find 180 different genes that contributed to human height. And with knowing all 180 of those genes, they could still only predict about 15% of the variation that they saw in different people. When you look at dogs and you ask for body size or for, height at withers, and you ask the same question, what are the genes responsible? It only takes you, a couple hundred dogs looking at, tens of thousands of markers, and you can find the two or three genes that are responsible for about 70 to 80% of the variation in the trait. So the number of genes that underlie these differences is much less. And in fact, within a breed, it's typically only one or two genes that contribute to the risk for a disease. And so it enables geneticists to sort of take this shortcut and figure out, because dogs and humans get many of the same diseases or very, very similar diseases. And so if there's a disease in humans and you can't explain, it's genetic, but you don't know all of the genes responsible for it. If there's a similar disease in dogs, you can design a study that's much smaller in the dogs, figure out what the gene is in the dogs. And there's been cases then when you go back and you look at that gene in humans or a related gene in humans, you see, oh, wow, actually that's responsible for, 20 or 50% of the disease risk in humans, and we didn't even realize that.
Oh, interesting. So could you, or do we already know this from studying genetics, could we get many of the same diseases, but dogs also are remarkably free of things like colds. Can we determine from your genetic examination here why it is that they don't get colds and we do, and if we figure that out, we wouldn't get colds?
That is a very good question. Yeah, so there is definitely canine influenza virus. I don't know that genetically you'd be able to necessarily to look and say, okay, well, this is the reason why dogs don't get it. There's some similarities in the way the immune systems of humans and dogs are set up, but there are some important differences. That's a very good question. I think village dogs are also interesting with regard to that, because they sort of live in a dirtier environment, which might be, the environment that dogs have always lived in, but also that humans lived in ever since the agricultural, sure, revolution. And only in recent modern times have we gotten the advances in hygiene that we start to see some diseases, like asthma and things like that, that are thought to be a result of overactive immune systems because they don't, And so it'd be interesting to see if dogs have those parallels as well. Right now, I don't know that anybody's been able to make those parallels genetically.
Here's a rather lengthy email, so stay with us. From Martin in New Berlin. When mentioning what we know as purebreeds through the artificial selection of selective breeding and that they may be more recent constructs, how does that relate with cultural evidence to what is believed to be older breeds, talking in the thousands of years, like the Greyhound, the Saluki, the Mediterranean breeds? where there are limited, where there are minted coins, tomb drawings, and other such artifacts that would date the breeds as rather ancient. Is it a case that what we see as these breeds are descendants of a common ancestral dog that was similar in appearance, then natural and directive selection added in some variation? Or is there genetic evidence that they are of something breeds, different breeds?
Right. So, I mean, of course, there were breeds of dogs, like he mentioned in the email, thousands of years ago. I mean, we have very good evidence. You know, a picture of a Saluki on a coin is good evidence that there was a dog, right, that looked like a Saluki back then. And when we look genetically at Salukis, they actually don't look like other modern breed dogs that you know, came from Europe in the last 200 years. They actually look most like Egyptian village dogs. So that's pretty good evidence that they were sort of taken from some population near Egypt and sort of separated out and have been, you know, breeding, you know, since then. At the same time, I don't think they had the same closed population structure that you see in modern breeds. So I think there probably was some back and forth between village dogs and these dogs being kept as Salukis for, you know, for their behavioral and phenotypic traits. On the other end of the spectrum, we also know that there were ridgeback dogs in sub-Saharan Africa thousands of years ago. I mean, it's a very distinct phenotype. We see it in archaeological, drawings and things like that. But when we look at modern Rhodesian ridgebacks, the primary signal that we see genetically is that they look like they came from Europe. Well, we don't think that the dogs from thousands of years ago came from Europe, but what we think happened is, at least in the individuals we looked at, they descended from this a reconstituted breed. So the breeders maybe took this one gene, but then they crossed it with modern dogs enough, and then they just sort of tried to keep that ridge gene in there, but then have it do different things. And so what we see now is just an amalgam of a whole bunch of different breeds, most of them not African at all.
Hmm. Our phone number, if you want to join the conversation, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Adam Boyko is our guest. His work is featured in the current issue of National Geographic, What Dogs Tell Us, the ABCs of DNA. Adam is an assistant professor in biomedical sciences at the Cornell University College of Veterinary Medicine, and he's looking at the genomic investigation of dogs as a model of genetic disease and evolutionary genetics. He's done some fascinating work along with family members looking at the genetics of village dogs in Africa, and also has done research as to the disappearance of village dogs in South America, where they were replaced by European breeds. So we'll be back with you in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow at 10, James Madison, the book on James Madison. Let's go to more phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. And we go to Tom in West Bend next. Hi, Tom.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, Tom. How are you?
Good. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Where do hyenas fit into this whole picture of the dog world? I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Thanks, Tom.
That's a great question. I wish I had a phone a friend here, because I know some colleagues that are really great at
at
canid phylogeny. But the short answer is they're pretty distinct. I mean, they're not quite as far out as cat, but they're pretty far out. And they're really remarkable animals. I mean, the social system and the physiology that they have is quite fascinating. But unfortunately, what we find out about dogs doesn't really translate that closely to hyenas. They're pretty distinct.
I don't know very much about hyenas. He's piqued curiosity here.
Well, I'm not a hyena expert either. But it's a female dominated society, and so it sort of turns on its head the social structure that we see in most of the other canids.
Huh, interesting. An email from Laverne. Are dingoes dogs, or did they come from village dogs in Australia? How long have they been here? Did they come with Europeans, or were they there for thousands of years?
Ah, that's a terrific question. So, yeah, that's a question that was a puzzle for a while, because the geneticists realized that humans got to Australia about 40,000 years ago, and dogs weren't around back then. So we don't think that they followed the humans there. And if you look archaeologically, there's really no evidence of dingoes or other dogs on the Australian continent until about 6,000 years ago. And so, in fact, when we look at village dogs that we see throughout island Southeast Asia or East Asia, we see that they, in fact, do have a fairly close kinship with the dingo. So we think dingoes were village dogs that came about 6,000 years ago onto the continent at least once, and then sort of reverted into a more feral lifestyle. So whereas most dogs live very close with human settlements and just scavenge from humans, dingoes are able to live more or less autonomously. And I don't know if Australia is just a more benign environment or whatnot. They actually seem to be very, very closely related to the New Guinea singing dog, which is even more endangered than the dingo.
Hmm. Wanda in Fond du Lac. Hi.
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 I just had a quick question. I have a Pomeranian, and somebody had asked me the difference between I never knew this was that there's dogs that have hair and there's dog that has fur, and I'd like to know how you can tell the difference.
So I've heard that too, and I can't say that I'm an expert, but there's two different kinds of hair, one of which they call fur and one of which they call hair. And most dogs have both kinds, but some dogs, I think, for instance, poodles and dogs like that don't shed, they only have the one kind. I can't speak to Pomeranians specifically. There's been a lot of interesting stuff done with coat genetics, fur type and coat color in dogs, and it's a really great system. But as far as I know, people haven't looked into the issue of which genes are controlling one kind of hair versus the other kind of hair.
And why don't you give us, you can be specific if you'd like here, your overall assessment of the way that breeders are, their knowledge of genetics is being used for the good of the breeds of dogs and also perhaps for and not so good. We had a guest on a few weeks ago which stayed in my mind that dogs like pugs have been bred to have these really smashed-in noses, which is not very good for a dog and shortens his or her lifespan. How have we been manipulating genes? Is it for the most part okay or not?
Well, so for the first half of the question, I'll say that breeders are amazingly smart when it comes to genetics, and they're amazingly helpful to researchers like myself and veterinarian researchers, and they really do want to wipe out diseases when they start happening in their breeds, and they're very concerned about it, and we have breeders, you know, all the time that say, oh, this new disease has cropped up, I really need to figure out what it is so I can make sure I don't breed carriers and I don't want to see dogs afflicted with this.
Mm-hmm.
And they're almost without exception great to work with, and they have the best interests of the breed at heart. Now, at the same time, some of these traits that are exhibited by purebred dogs, it's difficult to get that trait into a breed without causing problems. And so we see excessive skin wrinkling in the Shar-Pei, and that's exactly related to Shar-Pei fever that we see. So the more wrinkling that you have in the Shar-Pei, the more problems you have with the
really?
Fever in the Shar-Pei.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And and in the case with the pug, you know, dogs started out with a wolf-like snout, and it's very difficult in just a few hundred generations to breed something with such an extremely short snout. And one of the problems with that is the skull case itself becomes flattened. And that responds to this selection a bit quicker than, let's say, the brain changing size responds to selection. So as a consequence, the brain inside the skull is almost too large. So you have problems like encephalitis with this. With the bugs. And in order to fit in the brain case, it actually rotates 17 degrees forward in the pug's skull. So they've got this sort of flipped brain.
Oh.
You know, it's incredible what has to happen in order for a pug to kind of work. And I mean, I think that they're great dogs, but at the same time, it would be nice, perhaps, if the breed standard was a little bit less extreme on this phenotype. But that's not the breeders trying to put in a gene that's causing this problem. I mean, if anything, they would love to see a way to healthily, you know, breed the dog to do this. I think it's a bit much to put the fault at the breeders. But it would be great to step back for some of these traits and think, is there a way that we could more safely build a dog for this breed?
Well, I think that my understanding of this was that they were bred because people found them in France to be attractive. It was sort of a sign of cuteness to make sure that you got the dog to have a snout like that, when indeed it's just it wasn't a natural thing to do.
Sure. And, I mean, geneticists have figured out that there's actually a few different genes. There's a few different ways that you can get a shorter snout.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we don't know specifically all the genes yet, and we also don't know whether some of the genes are a more safe way to do it than others. I mean, we don't know what all the correlated traits that go with selecting on this gene versus that gene.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing with body size, too. I mean, we know that small dogs live a lot longer than large dogs.
Right.
Is that just a consequence of body size and has nothing to do with any sort of genetic interactions, or are there specific genes on top of the size that have more of an effect or less of an effect? So,
we don't know that even though
the National Geographic article makes it sound like we've discovered all these things with the dogs, and we've explained a lot of the variation in the morphology that we see. It just opens up a whole host of other questions that. You know, really, I'm excited about hopefully tackling during my career.
Right. Yeah, well, it's exciting. Gary in Palmyra, hi.
Hi there.
Hi, Gary.
I was just calling to say we had adopted a village dog from Puerto Rico and brought her back here to Wisconsin just this past fall.
Oh, my.
That's great. So the Adopt-A-Sido program or just on your own?
Through a rescue operation called Island Dog.
Oh,
okay.
But my son had found her on the beach and kind of befriended her, and every morning she showed up at our hotel, and so we found her, and, you know, they helped us do the paperwork and the quarantine. All was done on that end, and all we had to do was pick her up at the airport, and I think just this time of year in Wisconsin, I wonder if she really thinks we did rescue her.
I was thinking that, yeah.
So she got to see her first snow.
You know, she's adapted really well. I think the resiliency of those dogs and the lifestyle they led just leaves them to kind of be carefree and accepting of whatever situation they come into. But she's been great. She sleeps with my son at night.
Yeah, that's great. I hear that they're terrific animals. You know, not aggressive. They can be very resourceful. So I wish you all the best luck with her.
How did she encounter her first snowfall, Gary?
She sniffed around a little bit, but didn't seem to, you know, kind of took it all in stride. So it was all good. And I noticed the same thing wherever you went. The dogs were very friendly. All seemed to be very docile. So there's something like 200,000 stray dogs on the island of Puerto Rico. So there's a lot of need there for help. But this adoption agency helped take care of all of it. So.
Oh, thanks for calling, Gary. Are there many such adoption agencies for village dogs? Adam?
So different countries definitely, some of them have adoption agencies. In Puerto Rico, I was familiar with the Adopt-A-Sato program, and I don't know if that's related to island dogs at all or not. But there are definitely, you know, Puerto Rican dogs walking around the mainland of the U.S. adopted as pets now. I think other countries that are further away, you see a bit less of that.
Hmm.
And certainly dog overpopulation is viewed as a big problem in a lot of areas of the world.
Right. Todd in Duluth. Hi, Todd.
Hi, how you doing?
All right, how are you?
Okay.
Good.
Got a question regarding the longevity of dogs. Irish Wolfhounds, shall we say, you know, live to be maybe seven. Labs, German Shepherds, Goldens, maybe 14. And the little Belgian Schipperjee will live to be 20, 21 fairly routinely.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of sounds like there might be, you know, the expression of a gene, and then maybe the loss of a gene would could possibly account for the shortness of the Irish Wolfhound and the giant breeds and their short lifespan, and the maybe a double expression of a gene that would account for the Schipperjee's longevity? Or
yeah, I mean, the short answer is we really don't know. I mean, we've looked at correlations, and body size is a terrific predictor. The breed body size is a terrific predictor of how long that breed is expected to live. And with the larger breeds, of course, not living as long as the smaller breeds do. And then whether there's genetic factors on top of that, or whether there's different genes that can make you big that maybe don't shorten your lifespan as much as other genes. You know, we have some candidates. There are genes in humans that affect growth and also affect longevity, and we know some of these affect growth in dogs. But it's difficult to design these studies because you sort of in an unbiased way need to get data from a whole lot of dogs and then how long they lived. And so, you know, if we just look at a university teaching hospital, you know, people just bring us their sick dogs, and you know, certain breeds are, you know, more likely to have owners that want to take them there. And so you get all sorts of biases in the data. But there are definitely efforts out there to get this information from tens of thousands of dogs, and then to start to get the genetic data that we can start to disentangle some of these more subtle and complicated correlations.
Emails. Let's take a couple from Helen. I've heard that Lhasa Apsos are more closely related to wolves than many other dogs that are more wolf-like because of their genetic isolation. I haven't found anything to verify this. Is there any truth to this assertion?
I haven't looked at Lhasa Apsos myself, so I can't say. That would be interesting. I think that they do have a pretty unique breed history, and so it would be interesting to see where exactly they fit in.
And another from John in Vernon. Could you comment on another ancient breed, the Siberian Husky? They lived for thousands of years along with the Chukchi people in relative isolation, so they may be even more ancient than the Whippets and the Salukis.
Yeah, right. So there is definitely a signature in dogs like Siberian Huskies and Finnish Spitzes and these other sort of wolf-like Nordic dogs, that there at some point was some additional wolf thrown, you know, mixed in to the breed a long time ago. It's not like they're half wolf, half dog, but we do sort of see a bit of a unique genetic signature in those breeds, making it look like at one point there was some wolf DNA that was tolerated, which is not usually the case for dog breeds. I mean, wolf dogs are not particularly good pets, and those genes typically don't get propagated and come back into breeds like they did apparently with the Siberian Husky.
Mary in Two Rivers. Hi, Mary. Hi, Mary. Are you there? All right, Mary is not there. Let's go to Rod in Weyerhaeuser. Hi, Rod.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I was just throwing this in the mix here. I live about 60 miles north of Eau Claire in the northern part of the state, and we've got quite a few red fox, and every once in a while you see a silver fox, so I'm just wondering how that fits in. I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you. About 60 miles north of Eau Claire.
Okay.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, so foxes are you know definitely in the canid carnivore group, but they are a separate branch from dogs. They're pretty distinct. Silver foxes, of course, are the species that was used in these farm fox experiments where they actually bred animals to be tame, and then they found that a whole lot of other traits in these foxes made them start to resemble dogs. It's just a really fascinating series of experiments that were being done and are still being done in Russia. So I'm not sure if he's talking about silver fox as a separate species or as a separate coat color on the red fox? I mean, I imagine that the same genes that control fur color in dogs are the ones that are active in the foxes as well. But I don't have any I haven't read any studies on coat color in foxes.
Hmm. Okay, thank you so much for your calls. Adam, thank you. What fascinating work you're doing. It's really interesting. Do you have, other than directing people to the National Geographic, is there a web page for the CanMap team where there's more information?
Well, we do have a web page for the Village Dog Project, which I'm embarrassed to say is a little bit out of date, but we're definitely working on it. I enjoy hearing from people, especially people that have adopted village dogs, tell me how they're doing. Sometimes if they have dogs from countries that we haven't been to and they're willing to lend a sample, we can try to analyze it.
Okay.
So the work is definitely ongoing, and I appreciate the opportunity to tell people about the project.
Thank you. Thanks, Adam. It was really interesting. Adam Boyko, Assistant Professor of Biomedical Science at Cornell University, the Village Dog Project, for more information about what they're doing and how you might be able to help. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for fittingly having a dog program on her final broadcast, and we again wish her very well as she leaves and goes to Minnesota Public Radio. All the best. I'll miss you. We'll be with you again tomorrow. James Madison and the State of the